we're going to go ahead and get started, even though Eddie isn't right here handy. He will be back in just a few seconds. And we're having a hard time getting our people to sit down for the Midrash.
But Teresa's here.
That was to get there. But we do have Teresa here, so get your earplugs. And hi, Teresa. Somebody said hello. We don't know who. No, but she is still deaf to the world. So
no, I am not a mute anymore. I almost have my full voice back. I'm still a little scratchy, but I'm doing much better. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Why don't we begin by reading the Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 to 20, and we'll get Midrash going. Eddie will be back to join us in just a couple of minutes. And Yahweh spake unto Moshe, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn, whatsoever openeth the womb among the women of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine. And Moshe said unto the people, remember this day in which ye came out from Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand Yahweh brought you out from this place. There shall no leavened bread be eaten. This day came ye out in the month of Aviv. And it shall be when Yahweh shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, that he swear unto thy fathers to give thee a land flowing with milk and honey, that thou shalt keep this service in this month. 7 days thou shalt eat unleavened bread, and the seventh day shall be a feast unto Yahweh. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in all thy quarters. And thou shalt show thy son in that day, saying, this is done because of that which Yahweh did unto me when I came forth out of Egypt. And it shall be for a sign unto thee upon thine hand, and for a memorial between thine eyes, that Yahweh's law may be in thy mouth. For with a strong hand hath Yahweh brought thee out of Egypt. Thou shalt therefore keep this ordinance in his season from year to year. And it shall be when Yahweh shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, as he sware unto thee and to thy fathers, and shall give it thee, that thou shalt set apart unto Yahweh all that openeth the matrix, and every firstling that cometh of a beast which thou hast, the males shall be Yahweh's. And every firstling of an ass thou shalt redeem with a lamb, and if thou wilt not redeem it, then thou shalt break its neck, and all the firstborn of men among thy children shalt thou redeem. And it shall be, when thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, what is this? That thou shalt say unto him, by strength of hand Yahweh brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that Yahweh slew all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to Yahweh all that openeth the matrix, being males. But all the firstborn of my children I redeem. And it shall be for a token upon thine hand, and for frontlets between thine eyes, for thy strength of hand Yahweh, by strength of hand Yahweh brought thee us out of Egypt. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that Elohim led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For Elohim said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, and they return to Egypt. But Yahweh, or Elohim, led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt. And Moshe took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from hence with you. And they took their journey from Sukkot and encamped at Etam in the edge of the wilderness. Just to give you a geographical idea, that was not a one-day journey from Sukkot to Etam. The pillar of fire went with them by night, the pillar of cloud went with them by day, and they never stopped from Sukkot to Etam. It's probably in the neighborhood of 150 miles. So they didn't walk that all in one day.
This chapter, Exodus chapter 13, is all about the redemption of the firstborn. And this is actually what creation is all about. When Adam was created, he was Yahweh's firstborn. But because he was disobedient to Yahweh, he got exiled from the Garden of Eden. And from that time, Yahweh promised that he would end up redeeming mankind, which is the descendants of Adam. So if he's redeeming the sin of Adam, he is redeeming the firstborn. Now, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, this is what the Almighty instructed Moses. In Exodus chapter 4, verses 22 and 23, "You shall say unto Pharaoh, Thus says Yahweh, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto you, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, even your firstborn." So, in redeeming the children of Israel out of Egypt, Yahweh was redeeming his firstborn, because Israel had become and was seen by Yahweh as a firstborn nation. And we, as believers in Yeshua as the Messiah, we are also seen as being a firstborn nation. In Hebrews, in chapter 12, verses 22 and 23, "You've come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living Elohim, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and congregation of the firstborn." See, we are told about Yeshua and the situation regarding his birth, that Yeshua is a firstborn. So Yeshua was born as a firstborn to be a firstborn redeemer of a firstborn nation. Because it says in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 25, "If your brother be waxen poor and has sold away some of his possession," how do you become poor? You depart from Torah. And the Torah is your possession. So if you sell your possession, you are leaving Torah. "And any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold." So Yeshua came to be a redeemer, the redeemer of Israel. He came to redeem the firstborn. Now, of that which is redeemed, you are to take a tenth of it and to give it to Yahweh. So we see then, when Yeshua tells us, and we have this incident of the 10 lepers in the Gospels, in Luke chapter 17, it says, "It came to pass in verse 11, as he went to Jerusalem, that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee, and he entered into a certain village. There met him 10 men that were lepers, which stood afar off." So he heals 10 lepers that were afar off, and he went through Samaria. This is a picture of the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, who in Daniel chapter 9, verse 7, are regarded as being far off. They have the spiritual status and condition of leprosy. But of those 10 that he healed, it says in verse 15, and one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back and with a loud voice glorified Elohim. Only one of the 10. So, and what this one did is only one of the 10 returned and glorified Elohim. Only one in 10 returned to glorify Elohim. Now, I've done a study on how Yeshua gets glorified. He prayed that in John chapter 17. I pray that they may be one. In the glory that you've given me, I've given them. Who's they be one, Ephraim and Judah. So it's when Ephraim and Judah become one that Yeshua is glorified. But who is it among those who are believers in him are there to give him glory, to be a part of his redemption and the ingathering of both houses of Israel? Only one in 10, a tithe, which the prophet says a remnant will return. Now, if we look at the 144,000, what is the role, what is their role, and what is it that is said of them? In Revelation chapter 14, verse 4, it says, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. So, the whole Bible is a story about how the God of Israel redeems his firstborn, and that the firstborn then becomes consecrated to him. So when the nation of Israel, who once again, I read earlier in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 22, the nation of Israel is called a firstborn. What is to be done with the firstborn? You're to consecrate him, dedicate him, set him apart unto Yahweh. So who is Israel as a nation? To be set apart, consecrated unto Yahweh for his service. And that is why it says in Exodus in chapter 4 and or Exodus chapter 3 and verse 12, Exodus 3, verse 12, certainly I will be with you, and this will be a token that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you will serve Elohim upon this mountain. Who is serving Elohim? The firstborn nation. That firstborn nation and serving Elohim is consecrated unto him. Consecrated unto him for for service unto the Almighty. And then it says in Leviticus, in chapter 25 and verse 55, for unto me the children of Israel are servants. They are my servants who I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your Elohim. So this chapter in Exodus chapter 13 is a very important chapter in the Torah because it lays out the redemption of the firstborn and the consecration of the firstborn who is redeemed. And notice when it says in verse 2, sanctify unto me all the firstborn, what is linked with that thought? Remember the day which you came out of Egypt, because the day of the coming out of Egypt was the redemption of the firstborn, of which we are to be servants. And how are we as servants? We follow Torah, and we allow ourselves as servants to be used by the Almighty for His glory and the glory of His kingdom and for His service. And so when it speaks about sanctify unto me the firstborn, verse 2, it says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. The thought is sanctification, holiness, set apart, being unleavened is a part of the consecration of the firstborn. And so this is understanding the big element and aspects of Yahweh's plan of salvation for the world, as specified in the Torah, is that the firstborn is to be redeemed and to set apart unto Yahweh. I'm going to give the floor to anyone else in the congregation, or even those in Paltalk land, who has some further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Exodus chapter 13, the first part of it, anything that has been discussed so far, or anything that anyone wants to share or convey regarding this chapter. Go ahead, Bill.
The word remembered here is an infinitive word, to be remembered constantly or continually, not to be forgotten. So whenever you see this word connected with Moshe or Yeshua or the prophets or something like that, it's usually an infinitive word that says, don't forget this. Remember it. Don't forget. And basically, what Eddie brought, the whole scope of this is true. And some of you may wonder, as I've had questions asked before, if the firstborn were to be consecrated, then why was sometime the firstborn overlooked? To me, the reason was because a lot of it was because of their heart. He already knew. And Yahweh, we don't question him. He chooses whom he pleases. He's the one that created. He's the one that has the master plan. And this is his doings. The Lord, it's the Lord's doing, to do the way he wants to. But he's telling these people for a reason. It's also not only to preserve the line in the firstborn, but to show obedience to him. And that's why he wants us to remember these things. And that's why we do what we do. That's why we do the feast days, to remember. And I tell everybody, when we do the feast days, I said, like Eddie said, we don't do them right. Probably don't, because we don't understand the true workings of. We can only go by, you know, what we've been told, and sometimes we find things that maybe we shouldn't be doing, and we stop doing them, or some things that should be added that we add. So it's a learning process for us, and we weren't there at Mount Sinai, so we don't know all that. You know, that we don't know how much is missing here that we need to do. But I always. The word stands out to me is the word remember.
Anything else that anybody would like to share about Exodus in chapter 13? Now, in speaking about the redemption and sanctification of the firstborn, notice in verse 4, it says, this day you came out in the month of Aviv. So the redemption of the firstborn is specifically related and associated with Passover. Passover is the festival of the redemption of the firstborn. We also see this principle that, you know, without fearing the God of Israel and having a personal relationship with him, you think that mankind thinks that I work hard, this is mine, it belongs to me, and maybe I'll share it if I think about it, and you can have the leftovers even if I do share. You know, you can have the hand-me-downs. But here in the Torah, when you realize that everything belongs to your Maker, you are to serve him, And we are to give him our best. And what ultimately is the best thing that we could give him that he wants? That's it. Our lives. That's what he wants. He wants us to give him our lives, which means if we give him our lives, we give him everything that we have, all of our possessions. We give him our thoughts. We give him our desires. We give him our will. And so we see here when it talks about and every firstling of a donkey you will redeem with the lamb and etc. It's talking about the firstborn of beast is to be Yahweh's as well. So the principle is that what we have is not our own. We are to realize that everything comes as a blessing. Everything comes from our Maker, and we are to recognize that, honor that, and give it back unto Him. And since He owns everything anyways, He will take care of us. That's His responsibility, and to bless us. Mark.
Tom wants to say something. Why don't we let him go first?
Just a quick question. In verse 13, why were they to break the neck of the donkey if they choose not to redeem it?
See?
It is
good thing we went in this order, because he asked the question and you got the answer.
And I got the answer, I think. Okay. I'm looking at Stone's Chumash on the 13th. Now, this is interesting. First issue donkey is what it says on verse 13. The only non-kosher animal that is included with the firstborn blessing is the donkey. Okay? All the other animals are clean. Okay? Now, here's why the rabbi said. Sephorno, verse 14, explains that the donkey is a reminder of the Exodus, because the Egyptians were so insistent upon Israel's immediate departure from their country that there was no time for them to obtain enough wagons for their considerable possessions. Therefore, everything had to be loaded upon donkeys. Normally, they would never have borne so heavy burdens, but that they did so was another of the miracles of the Exodus, hence the special treatment of donkeys. Personally, I think that's a bunch of hogwash. And I said that really nice, didn't I? Because what was in my head to say was, but anyway,
it couldn't be donkey wash.
It couldn't be donkey. Well, it could be, but I think the reason the donkey was included is because of the special place that it has in the birth of Messiah, in carrying his mother, who could never have walked that distance as pregnant as she was, and gotten to Israel. And go ahead.
And carrying the lamb that it's redeemed by into Jerusalem on Lamb Selection Day.
There you go.
So in both cases, the donkey was redeemed with a lamb in the Gospels.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's very good. Thank you. We're thinking in the same vein, but we come up with different ideas. But I think that's the reason the donkey is the one that gets to...
Maybe Mark thinks you're getting better now that you're starting to think like him.
She says she's getting more ill because she's thinking like me. Go ahead, Bill.
I want to ask a question. Is it possible that the ass here represents all the unclean animals also? Is it possible?
Yes. It's possible, but that's kind of a big stretch. Kind of a big stretch, but it's possible.
Wait a second. If donkeys are unclean, and we have a political party in the United States that's a donkey party, does that mean if you vote for them, you're being unclean?
Yes, but you see, elephants are unclean as well.
Oh, okay.
So that kind of backfires on you Republicans, doesn't it? That's a good point, too. Liz says, you know, the donkey is the only animal that God actually gave a voice to who spoke to man. That one time, they did that with Balaam's ass. Okay, Rabbi Hirsch comments that donkeys are symbolic of material possessions. By commanding us to redeem them for a sheep, the animal that by its use as the Pesach offering made Israel Elohim's servant, the Torah shows us that all material possessions must be dedicated to his service as well. So That's another good application of that thing. That's your relative, Hirsch, huh? Rabbi Hirsch. I heard that, Liz. I'm telling you. Every once in a while, you can pull a gem out of these Hebraic commentaries, I'm telling you. Now we're back to the blind squirrel theory. That's right. Other questions or comments?
Anybody else, congregation or in Pow Talk, have any further questions or comments? I got the scripture that I was referring to earlier, Luke chapter 2 and verse 7. It says, "And she brought forth her firstborn son." Yeshua is a firstborn. He is in the natural a firstborn son, but he is in Romans chapter 8, verse 29, it says that Yeshua is the firstborn among many brethren. Then in Colossians 1:15, it says that he's the firstborn of every creature. And so we see why the Messiah is connected with the firstborn, because if the Messiah is going to be the Redeemer and the Savior of Israel, he has to be a firstborn, because it's the firstborn that redeems those who were firstborn, but they sold away their possessions. It's the duty to redeem your fellow Israelite and to bring them and restore them into covenant relationship with the God of Israel. Right? It's been mentioned here that he's the firstborn from the dead, and that's Colossians chapter 1 and verse 18. Tom reminded us of. Anybody else in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any further thoughts, questions, comments about what we've shared so far, or a thought or a comment regarding what is contained here in Exodus in chapter 13. We've basically covered the first part, and we are discussing the first part of Exodus in chapter 13. Anybody else?
Susie, I have a little comment. I was just thinking about what Bill was saying regarding some firstborns being passed over or left out, but I know it's still a choice, even though the firstborn, there's a redemption through the firstborn, that the firstborn still has a choice whether or not they themselves, as individuals, will be set apart unto Yahweh, take up that place themselves and give their lives to Yahweh.
You know, when I was younger, teenage years, going to church, every once in a while, we would sing the song, Take My Life and Let It Be Consecrated, Lord, to Thee. Anybody else have a thought, question, comment regarding anything we've covered so far?
Yeah, real quick, like.
Go ahead.
The remembrance in verse 3. It says, "Remember this day in which ye came out from Egypt," in which ye came, they hadn't come out yet, and he's already speaking in past tense. "Remember this day in which ye came out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Let's see. And in verse 5, "When Yahweh shall bring thee into the land." So he's looking forward to something that, as far as he's concerned, is already done. The unimaginable ability for Moshe to understand Yahweh's prophetic plan and to tell it to his people as if it had already happened, so that they believe that it already is done, is incredible to me. He's just...
We have a question on Pal Talk. Could you comment on Jeremiah 31:9, for I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn? Well, Ephraim being his firstborn is a reference back to Genesis in chapter 49, wherein the firstborn blessing was given by Jacob to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it was the firstborn that was to be given the double blessing, so that they would have the economic wherewithal to redeem anyone in the family who would sell away their possessions. And you remember in the parable of the prodigal son in Luke in chapter 15, where it says in verse 11, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said, Father, give me the portion of good that befalls to me. That has to be Ephraim, because when he says, give me the portion of goods that belongs to me, that is the aspect of the double blessing of the firstborn. You get the inheritance. So he's saying, give me my inheritance now. And the parable here is that rather than using that inheritance for redemption, he initially goes out and spends it on riotous living. But the fact that Ephraim was made and given to be a firstborn, and the firstborn is to have material blessing. And we know that Ephraim in the world, in the exile, was given material blessing of the physical earth and the physical resources of the earth. And ultimately, the reason why the father did that was for the day when Ephraim would become responsible and use that blessing to bless Judah, so that ultimately the redemption of the family could come about from the blessing that Ephraim had that he could give unto Judah. Now it says in Isaiah in chapter 1 and verse 27, it says, Zion shall be redeemed with judgments, and with, it says in the King James, righteousness, but the Hebrew word is Zedekah. Zion will be redeemed with Zedekah, which means charity, good deeds. Well, part of the way in which you are able to do charity and good deeds is you have to have material substance to be able to be used as an object of your good deeds. And Ephraim's got an obligation and a responsibility to use his blessing of a firstborn to not only be a blessing to Judah, and thus help to facilitate the redemption, but the firstborn, Ephraim, corporately, is the one that believes that Yeshua is the Messiah, and they're carrying with them Messiah, who Messiah is, which they're carrying with them the redemption that comes with being firstborn and proclaiming the Redeemer, Yeshua the Messiah. So this is why Ephraim is called a firstborn, and this is the task of Ephraim in being faithful in that firstborn responsibilities. We have a follow-up question on Pal Talk. Does this mean that Ephraim has a double responsibility to help redeem the rest of Israel? He's got a double blessing. So, and whose purpose of that double blessing is to be a blessing to the rest of Israel to facilitate the redemption. That's right. He to as much is given, much is required.
That's exactly right. When you get a double blessing, you do have a double responsibility. Absolutely. You do not get a blessing, you do not get any kind of authority unless you're given the responsibility to carry it out.
Anybody else in congregation or Pal Talk? Yes, Tom.
Yeah, this is the second time you're speaking. It must,
yeah, you
must
normally
be
don't get these. You normally don't get these brainstorms until at the end of the midrash, not at the beginning.
I got to take up the slack. As Bill mentioned earlier, he was talking about remember. I see a theme in this portion we're looking at here. Is that fact that we need to remember. I was noticing how in verse 8 and 14 we're commanded to, you know, to pass it on to your children. You shall tell your son, or when your son asks you. I'm just amazed at how the society we live in, we have forgotten. It's just mind-boggling to see how far we've strayed from the Torah. And we know that Torah is the words of life, even to a non-believer. If you do Torah, it promotes life, and this portion here in 16, so it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as phylacteries on your forehead. It's just, I just keep seeing here reminder and pass it on, teach the truth, the Torah.
Eddie, you mentioned that Zion would be redeemed with tzedakah. Was that Isaiah 127?
Correct.
Okay. King James says that he shall be redeemed with judgment and her converts with tzedakah. Okay? So Zion is going to be redeemed with mishpat and her proselytes or whatever with tzedakah, with good works. Just wanted to... Shuv, actually converts, shuv, people who turned. Okay, so they're turned back. So Zion is going to be redeemed with judgment, and those who return to Yahweh among them with tzedakah. But the application is still very valid. That's how we're going to get Judah to even bother looking at us.
Yeah, in the Hebrew, I had looked this up when Eddie was talking about it with us during Oneg. It literally reads Zion. In judgment is redeemed and returns with Zedekah or with or in Zedekah.
No.
They translate that. It's literally how it reads in the Hebrew.
Can you do that word for word?
Yes. Zion be mishpat.
Which means?
Which it's actually mishpatim.
In judgment.
With judgment.
So Zion with judgment.
With judgment. Tipada is to redeem or is redeemed.
Zion with judgment is redeemed.
Ve, which is and. Shuv.
And returns.
Returns. Be. Zedekah. With or in, depending on how you...
All right.
Be. And Zedekah. Is literally word for word in Hebrew.
And so the King James actually... It arranges the thought. The King James arranges the thought a little bit differently. Where you shared it word for word. Now in Pal Talk, a couple good comments. One is that Abraham was given the blessing of being the father of many nations, and that part of being a father of many nations or a blessing unto many nations was passed to Ephraim, because Ephraim is many nations and a blessing of many nations. And then another comment is a question: could this be could this be the donkey carrying Yeshua representing Ephraim? I actually believe the donkey itself, when Yeshua rode on the donkey, that the donkey represents Ephraim, and it represents he was coming and showing mastery over Zion, or over Ephraim, ruling and reigning over Ephraim. Mm-hmm. That by riding on the donkey, that he was showing that the wildness of Ephraim, which a donkey's wild, he would be the Messiah of Ephraim and being able to ride him. And he rode the donkey into Jerusalem. So it's Ephraim and Messiah coming into... Ephraim would be coming into the land. He would be believing in Yeshua.
The important thing about being firstborn is having firstborn hearts upon those that will recognize the importance of the ways of Yah. The covenant was established there at Passover. There the covenant was begun, and it was upon the doorposts that there was a blood contract, and the lamb became the sacrificial animal, and they had to... Yahweh passed over the opening and did not take the firstborn, but then they had to pass through that same portal and going through and entering into that covenant, just as there was a covenant that was established between Yahweh and Abraham, and they had laid out the animals and they had to walk between the two. But Abraham was put to sleep so that Yahweh made the covenant that he would keep that. But they did make the covenant to keep the Passover. It was the first covenant that was established, the first feast that was established with Israel as a people, that would be done. And that was impressed upon them in verses 9 and 16. It talks about placing it upon their hand and upon the, before their foreheads, their eyes. Now it says it, meaning that which is the redemptive act of Yahweh, he has brought it forth. And it's not something that they would actually mark their hand or put something before their, actually have any kind of a fob or any kind of a bill that they would actually have before their eyes or actually have on their hand, but they would be impressed there, just as Yeshua said that you had to drink my blood and eat my flesh. Those are spiritual words. Those were spiritual words that were spoken and imparted to Israel at that time, that they would have to make a conscious effort to be able to recognize the importance of the mighty right hand of Yahweh, which is Yeshua, to have delivered them out. And just as the hand has the five fingers of the grace of God, the grace was extended to them to bring them out. And before their eyes, which is in their mind, which as we see is the place where the helmet of salvation is, and we have to continue to be reminded of having experienced salvation because of the grace of Yahweh. And so then we were able to go then forward. But it's again having the hearts of the firstborn, being able to embrace all that is in the covenant, all that was within the relationship being built up in Yahweh, and how important that really is, and having the desire then, once you have his heart within you, you have birthed within you the same redemptive desires to see redemption take place, to see it become a part of the program of your life, so that you want to reach out to those around you and see this redemptive act fulfilled and brought forth.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? We're still discussing Exodus in chapter 13. You know, I see a principle. If we journey on to verse 17, it says, "It will come to pass when Paro has let the people go that Elohim led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For Elohim said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, and they return to Egypt." See, in order to conquer the promised land, it required war. Whether that is physical war or spiritual war, it still requires war. Usually both. I mean, in order to do the will of the Father, it involves some massive spiritual warfare, and in some instances, physical warfare as well. And Human beings do not like warfare. They want to run away from warfare, whether it's physical warfare or whether it is spiritual warfare. We don't even like spiritual warfare. And so we are communicated a principle that in order for us, after coming out of Egypt, in order for us to get to the promised land, those who are afraid of war are not going to be able to make it to the fullness of what the God of Israel has for them. If you're not willing, taking this spiritually, if you're not willing to fight the good fight of faith, you're not going to see the good of the land, the fullness of what the Father has for you. You might see an element or aspect, but not the fullness of it.
And the good fight of faith may actually involve physical fighting. Okay?
Definitely in the end of days, that's what it ultimately could come to.
As Bill said, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. There you go. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if Moshe had taken them on the easy, quick route to Israel, to Canaan, it would have been the northern route, and it would have confronted the Philistines. And the Philistines, they would have run into them within a day or two. And the Philistines, who are just like they are now, or were just like they are now, would have immediately fought. And remember now that this northern end route, which is more direct, is also an easier route to traverse. Okay, so here are the people who are afraid of war. They come upon a warlike tribe, the Philistines. They have to start to fight. It's an easy trip back to Egypt. They just do an about face and go. But the route that they had taken was through the desert. Yahweh took them on a 3-day trip, 3 days night and day, because they had to make 160 miles just about to get from Sukkot to Etam. That's a forced march. And we're talking about moving 4 or 5 million people, like we were talking about last week. 6 million people, that far, that quick. That's why it took them until they got to Etam before they could actually stop and camp overnight. That was where they got their one night's rest. And then they traveled for 2 or 3 more days down the wadi to Pi Hahiroth at the edge of the Red Sea. So it took them the better part of a week to make that trip. And also that means that they got to the other end, and they had to keep a Shabbat at the end thereof. Okay, at least the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread with Pharaoh at the other end of the wadi. Okay, and it's not just a wadi; it's a canyon that nobody can get through, nobody can get away from. So that's why Moshe. The Pharaoh in the movie, the God of Israel, is a very bad general. Remember? Okay, so Yul Brynner, yeah, playing the part. I mean, I got a feeling that that's pretty close to exactly what Pharaoh said. You know, this God of Israel may be powerful, but he ain't too bright, you know, leaving those people down there. So, anyway, the fact is that they made it in 2 trips, traveling about 220, 240 miles in 2 marches. That is Yahweh's empowering. That's what the Spirit of Yahweh can do. So if, you know, it comes down to having to fight, the Spirit of Yahweh is going to give you the ability. It'll be up to you to decide whether or not to believe that He's given it to you or not.
I think what Mark just said was so important about this taking the 7 days journey, because we get that right from this passage. This passage leads us into what we'll see next week is Pharaoh in pursuit, which is what Mark was just describing. And we've got here, you know, everybody looks at chapter 13 and says, oh, this is Passover. Well, it is, but it isn't. This is more about the Feast of Unleavened Bread in those 7 days. Mm-hmm. All of chapter 12 is about Pesach. And now he starts to say, remember that you were brought out. The Lord has delivered you. And verse 6, for 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day shall be a Moed, a feast to Yahweh. Unleavened bread shall be eaten through the 7 days. Nothing leavened shall be seen among you, nor shall any leaven be among you in all your borders. You shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. What did the Lord do for us when he brought us out of Egypt? He protected us for 7 days. 7 days he protected us from Pharaoh, from breathing down our backside. Even on that high Sabbath when he kept us at the Red Sea, he kept us there, protecting us with that. What we'll see in verse 21 next week, right where this leaves off, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. Unleavened bread is talking about consecration. In that 7 days, he took us out of Egypt on that night after Passover meal. And then for 7 days, he consecrated us. For 7 days, he took Egypt out of us. There were a few of us who still had rumblings later on. But he was trying to purge Egypt out of us, even by showing us, even with Egypt on your tail, I will take this away from you. But we don't want to see it during that feast we just celebrated. We want to think all the nice things, or we want to think, oh, we kept Passover, now we're just doing this. We're not only commanded to avoid leaven during those 7 days, we are commanded to consume unleavened or pure things. That's a positive command for this time. Why? Because we're not only to see what we're being delivered out of, we're to see what we're being delivered to. That's what Yahweh did for us when he brought us out of Egypt during this time.
I think one of the things that needs to be remembered is the fact that in the church, the teaching is when you get saved, then it's a straight line to heaven. And you know what? Scripture says differently, that it's not an easy road sometimes we travel. And he doesn't necessarily...
But the song says there's a highway.
Yeah, I know there's a highway. There is a highway, but they're forgetting, if they're on that highway, they're forgetting one thing. That there's a lot of S-curves and detours and everything on that highway. If you don't believe that there's detours, when you get to meet Jonah, you ask him about the detour that he went on. You see, so we need to basically keep focused, and wherever he leads is where we need to go. And basically, when he leads us around, he's taking us on the right path, but we just don't see it. And that's what he was doing to these people. He was protecting them in one sense, but it was a sign of obedience for him to do that too. And he already knew what they would do. They'd probably flee. You know, they weren't adapted at warfare, although there were supposed to be some there that were adapted to that. But again, the case is to remember.
One more real quick. This also from the Humash. I usually, you know, I bought this thing about 5 or 6 months ago, and it's amazing how many really good applications there are to be found in this thing. I never would have thought it, but you know what? It's like a Jewish study Bible, you know. Okay, so you know, some of it's really good, some of it's really crap. You got to decide which one it is by reading it yourself. Anyway, here's a good comment about another reason for the decision to lead them through the desert. Elohim wanted them to be in circumstances where they would have to see constant miracles in order to survive. This would be their schooling in faith, for they would see through the manna, the water, the rest of the, and protection from the elements, and so on. That it was Elohim is omnipresent and omnipotent. As a result, for the rest of our national history, we would look back and know that everything is in God's hands. A lesson that is clearest in a desert where human survival, especially for a nation of millions, would have been impossible without divine intervention. That is an excellent, excellent point. They got to see firsthand that only by the power of Yahweh could they have done what they did. I mean, he led them for 3 days and three nights without a break. They weren't able to stop for anything. Another reason they had to have unleavened bread. There's no way that they could have stopped to cook. Okay, anyway. That's all I got for that.
One thing I want to mention is I'm thoroughly amazed about the forced march. Now, I was in the Army, and they'd get us up in the middle of the night and say, we're going on a 30-mile hike. And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that,
wake me up at 8.
That it was a force. It was supposedly a mock force march, and we had to do it. And I'm going to tell you guys that that is not an easy thing to do. This was we didn't have the light maybe that they had, but still they're going through the desert. We went on roads, you know, and sometimes we got separated. There was sometimes you had to run, sometimes you had to walk because some idiots didn't know what they were doing. I guess I don't know, but 25 or 30 miles force march. It's very taxing. For them to do what they did, if it's up to 250 miles in 2 days,
two trips,
that's awesome. That is really awesome.
You know, that is about how long it would take, too. If you think about it, you're moving all those people. You're not going to be moving more than 2 or 3 miles an hour. You know? Go 240 miles at 3 miles an hour, you're talking about an 80-hour march. You know? That's 3.5 days just if you go in a straight line. And I remember they didn't have just a couple of million people. They also had all of their flocks and all of their herds. You know, they're lucky to be making 2 miles an hour, probably. But they made it for 3 days without a stop, all the way to Etam at the top of the at the head of the wadi, and then down the canyon from there.
Okay, verse 20, Exodus 13, and they took their journey from Sukkot. So remember, what happened historically is a prophetic foreshadowing what will happen in the end of days, in the end of the exile of the house of Jacob. And they took their journey from Sukkot. Sukkot, thematically, is where you gather and you are to live in tents. The children of Israel left from a physical place called Sukkot, and they were tabernacling on their journeys because they lived in tents. And many people ask, you know, what about the end of days? Well, the end of days, we will take our journey from Sukkot as well.
Perhaps from a feast of Sukkot?
Perhaps, definitely. The Exodus is not only connected to Passover, but to Sukkot as well. Because in Leviticus, in chapter 23, one of the reasons given of why we are to celebrate Sukkot, and Leviticus 23:42, and verse 43, you will dwell in booths 7 days, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. So they came out of Egypt at Passover, but they did it by dwelling in booths. And you're to celebrate tabernacles, and in doing so, you're to remember that that's how you came out of Egypt, which was Passover. So Passover is linked with tabernacles,
which is why this passage links both of them in Exodus 13:1-20. It goes through, and you've got the 8 days, if you count the 14th of Aviv and preparing for Passover. You've got the 7 days of unleavened bread.
Mm-hmm.
We're to do this every year from year to year and tell our children, this is what God mm-hmm. did for us when we came out of Egypt. And what does the last verse of our portion say today? And they journeyed to Sukkot. Scripture links these two. A lot of times, if you're studying the annual Torah portions, you'll study Sukkot in the spring and you'll study Passover in the fall. Why is that? Because they're linked. They're the same number of days. They're the same themes thematically. You've got the same things going on. You've got the same thing about coming out and living in tents, as Eddie just said. And you've got the living in tents preparing and learning so that you can go out. They're almost shadow pictures of one another.
I think it's interesting also to remember the fact that from feast day to feast day and those days in between, that if we're faithful to him and keep him, then he's going to be there in between those times. That's a part of the picture here.
Yes. Reading from Numbers chapter 33, verses 1 through 7, it says, "These are the journeys of the sons of Israel by which they came out from the land of Egypt by their armies, under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. And Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys by the command of Yahweh. And these are their journeys according to their starting places. And they journeyed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the next day after the Passover, the sons of Israel started up boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom Yahweh had struck down among them. And Yahweh had also executed judgments on their gods. Then the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses and camped in Succoth. And they journeyed from Succoth and camped in Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. And they journeyed from Etham and turned back to Pahiharoth, which faces Baal Zephon, and they camped before Migdol." Now, this is called the month of Aviv. So we know that it is the month that's to be set apart as a month which recognizes the barley coming to head, the first of the fruits, and they were to be then the first fruits. And we know that Yeshua was the fulfillment of this type and shadow. And he, of course, was crucified there on Wednesday night and came forth on the evening of the Shabbat, the weekly Shabbat. And I would believe it was according to that that we recognize he has been our first fruits. And so the first fruits would have been begun on that same time, which had been on the eve of the Shabbat, then when they were coming out of Egypt and then probably passing from Etam, and they were the first fruits. And so at that time, they were being given special provision. And I think I've get to the place where I'm going to pass.
Well, Dad, actually, I was going to ask about first fruits when you started talking about that, Dad. I was going to ask about first fruits and how it's correlated with this passage, because I've been thinking about it. We didn't really recognize, when we didn't get together as a congregation to celebrate first fruits, but we really should, because it's when Yeshua rose. It's first fruits as he went to the Father and ascended, and he took a host with him. But I was thinking of and it being even kind of a picture when they take the bones of Yosef, and it talks about, I mean, the type of Ezekiel 37, when the dry bones become flesh. But when there are the bones that they bring with them that are Yosef's bones, and that's kind of a picture of a foreshadow looking forward to the rising, those who are dead and coming alive.
Right. So they became like the army that in Ezekiel chapter 37, where they became alive because the Spirit of Yahweh breathed on them. And then also we have at that time from the first fruits is the counting of the Omer until the time which comes up to Shavuot. And so they're in a period of time which is the counting off of the Omer. And so for us, we're in that time right now as well.
Anybody else have further thoughts, questions, comments, which they would like to share? We are still discussing Exodus in chapter 13. Anyone else? Well, our Brit Hadashah portion, no, not Brit Hadashah, our half Torah, is Yeshayahu, Isaiah chapter 46, verses 3 and 4, which says, "Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb. And even to your old age I am he, and even to hoar hairs will I carry you. I have made, and I will bear, even I will carry, and I will deliver you." So in the theme of the firstborn, redemption of the firstborn, we have these verses here of Yahweh's promise that he will redeem Israel from her exile. Mark.
Is this the idea that it says, which are born by me from the belly? Could this mean that Goshen, Egypt, is the belly in which Israel was formed? Okay.
Yeah, well, it's through the coming out of Egypt that the nation was born. And you were born from the belly. Go ahead.
I had to think about that for a second, but I think Mark's onto something there, because you've got, if you're being formed...
Blind squirrel time again, huh?
Yeah, blind squirrel time. If you've got Israel being formed in the womb, which is Egypt, your hypothesis actually plays out, because as they come out of Egypt, the waters broke, and they came through, and they were birthed. So it does play out,
exactly.
Both in the physical and the
fact,
spiritual.
That was Egypt all the way to the edge of the Red Sea.
Yes. Correct.
And the blood of the blood of the Egyptians was required.
And looking at chapter 46, it begins with which is the beginning of an idea of these two figurehead gods of the Chaldeans being bent over, being stooped and bowing before the greatness of Yahweh. They're burdened with this man's system, a pagan system. And yet in the midst of all this, in the midst of this pagan system and all this wickedness of the world around them, that is the belly. I mean, this is the place where Yahweh has chosen to bring forth the life of his very firstborn, his people, in the midst of a very wicked and evil place. He kept Egypt in a place where there was the pagan practices and the whole of the Babylonian religious system had already permeated so much of Egypt, and yet there is where he chose to bring forth his people, to cause them to grow to great, huge numbers, to bring them forth and to bring them out. But yet, as the verses that follow, it talks about the greatness of Yahweh. How he says, "I am so I can declare the beginning from the end." And even as we go into Psalms 50, and talk about everything belongs to me, the greatness of Yahweh. He is the one who is responsible for doing all these things, and he is going to cause his name to be great because he is going to bring this forth. He's going to bring deliverance for his people. And then the next thing that follows is with his greatness and all that he knows and all that he's bringing about in his redemption, is he's going to bring about the final destruction of that which is Babylon. And that's why when you read Revelation and you come to the final climax of his wrath being poured out in that final vial, the seventh vial, he's saving it up for Babylon, and he's completely destroying and obliterating all that remnant, all that idea of this pagan system. He's going to completely cleanse from the earth before he establishes his people and his kingdom.
To see a tie in Revelation 12, where the woman who is clad and she's pregnant and she's pain and labor and she's fleeing, and anyway, just and the fiery dragon's after, just again, those things. Yeah, that's right. The water comes to protect her and swallow her. Let's see. Anyway, yes, the protection of Yahweh is there as well.
It is blind squirrel time. Listen, the blind squirrel thought of something else. You know, all right, Teresa says, you know, they were born through the water. Okay, so they're born of water. And then a few weeks later, they're born of spirit at Mount Sinai.
And they started with blood.
And they started... Blood, water, and spirit. And these three agree in one.
Oh, my. That's awesome.
Wow, that's awesome. Eddie just said, wow, that's
awesome.
Is
it any surprise that that's in the little letter from John, the same person who wrote the gospel that started with Bereshit?
Yeah, and the same the same one that talked about being born of water and spirit. Yeah, I mean, that's just... I'm talking about the gospel. It spoke of being born of water and the spirit. Nicodemus, right. And then the... Wow.
Once again, to iterate what the Ruach is bringing on here, born of the blood, that's Passover, put the blood on the doorpost, and then you go through the water, born of water, and born of blood in the water.
Well, you go
and
through the
Mount
door
Sinai is
with
about
the blood.
About living by the Spirit. We're born of blood, water, and spirit. That is incredible. That's very, very good.
One thing might be interesting. Why is it important to keep Passover? There's 10 Passovers mentioned in Scripture. 10 of them. It has to do with the ordinance of perfection. Number 10 is. So this ordinance, as we do them, is supposed to, in our life, should show perfection to us too. To the learn. I can give them to you. It is Exodus 12:28, Numbers 9:5, Joshua 5:10, 2 Chronicles 30:13 through 15, 2 Kings 23:22, and in parentheses they have one, 2 Chronicles 13:5, Ezra 6:19, Matthew 26:17, Luke 2:41, and John, two places, 2:13 and 6:4. No, but that's, they had that in on the side.
Okay. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? We are specifically on Isaiah 46 and verses 3 and 4. Anybody else? How about if we go on then to Psalm 50? And Teresa studied this all week. And... she concluded that it's about exile and redemption.
Yeah, that was it.
So, you want me to read or you want to read, Mark? Right, Psalm 50. Okay, verse 1. The mighty Elohim, even Yahweh, has spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun unto the going down thereof. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, Elohim has shined. So what's the subject?
Zion.
That is the subject. What is Zion? Is the redemption of Ephraim and Judah in the end of days, the revealing of Messiah in the Messianic era. Our Elohim will come and shall not keep silence. A fire shall devour before him. This is speaking about when he redeems Zion, he does it in the fire of his jealousy. As it says in Ezekiel, in chapter 36, and verse 5, thus says Yahweh Elohim, in the fire of my jealousy have I spoken against the residue of the heathen, against all Edomiah, which is appointed my land for their possession with the joy of all their heart, with despiteful minds, to cast it out as a prey. Now, what else is referred to as the time of the fire of his jealousy? Gog, Magog, Ezekiel 38, and verse 19, which says, for in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there will be a great shaking in the land of Israel. So back to Psalm 50, it says in verse 2, out of Zion, Elohim has shined. Our God will come and will not keep silent. A fire shall devour before him. So it's talking about out of Zion he shines, and a fire will devour before him, because Zion is redeemed when he's judging the nations. He will call to the heavens from above and to the earth, that he may judge his people. He may judge his people. Now this goes and is connected to Jeremiah in chapter 30, where it says in verse 7, "Alas, for that day is great, it's none like it, it's the time of Yaakov's trouble, but he will be saved out of it." So, Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, Yaakov is saved out of trouble. And then it says in verse 11, "I am with you," that is Yaakov, says Yahweh, "to redeem you, to save you. Though I make a full end of all nations where I've scattered you, yet will I not make a full end of you, but I will correct you in measure and will not leave you altogether unpunished." So that's why it says in Psalm 50, verse 4, he will call to the heavens from above and the earth, that he may judge his people. See, he's shining out of Zion. It's the fire of his jealousy. He's judging the nations, and he's judging not only the nations, but judging his people. He'll not leave them altogether unpunished. "Gather my saints together unto me." Who is gathered unto him? Ephraim and Judah. "A covenant with me by sacrifice."
Passover.
"A covenant with me by sacrifice." Passover. When's the time of redemption of Ephraim and Judah? Passover. "And the heavens shall declare his righteousness." Why? Because when he redeems his people, it's being done in the sight of all the nations. As what it says at the end of Ezekiel in chapter 39. "Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, I will testify against you. I am Elohim, even your Elohim. I will not reprove you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings to have been continually before me. I will take no bullock out of your house, nor he-goats out of your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. Will I eat the flesh of bulls, or drink the blood of goats? Offer unto Elohim thanksgiving, and pay your vows unto the Most High, and call upon me in the day of trouble." Call upon me in the day of trouble. When's that? That's the tribulation. "And I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." When the two houses of Israel are redeemed, it's when the Messiah is glorified, which is Messiah's prayer in John chapter 17, verse 21. "I pray that they may be one. And the glory that you've given me, I've given them." Verse 16, "But unto the wicked," Elohim says, "what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that you should take my covenant in your mouth? Seeing you hate instruction and cast my words, but when you saw a thief, then you consent with him, and you have been partaker with idolaters. You give your mouth to evil, and your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's tongue. These things have you done, and I kept silence." So what's he talking about? The wicked. He's saying these things that the wicked have done, yet Yahweh has kept silent. He really hasn't come against and judged the wicked for their wickedness until he redeems Zion.
He's now talking about his own people here, Eddie. He's not talking about the heathen or anything like that. He's talking about his own children.
Okay.
This is Ephraim. This is us that he's talking about.
Okay. And it goes on to say, "You thought that I was altogether such as one as yourself, but I will reprove you and set you in order before my eyes." Well, that goes back to what I read earlier in Jeremiah chapter 30, that he's not going to leave Jacob altogether unpunished. "Now consider this, you that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces, and there be none to deliver. Whoso offers praise glorifies me, and to him that orders his conversation." That word is one who orders his way. It's halak. No, it's derek. He that orders his way. Derek is the way you walk. You live your life. "Will I show the salvation of Elohim. So what he's saying is those who seek to follow my Torah and follow after me, I'm going to show you my salvation. But those who despise my Torah, he's rebuking. And like Mark, thank you for pointing out that this here is referring to his own people.
That's right, because judgment begins at the house of Yah.
Right.
Does not begin out there. Begins right here.
Okay, Ron. Wait, Ron. Then ahead, Ron. Mark, and then Teresa.
Okay. I would agree with what Mark had pointed out in regards to being Ephraim, because I believe when he's saying speaking against your own brother, you see down through history how Ephraim has attacked Judah time and time again, without really any warrant or with any real reason to, other than the fact that they'll say that they're Christ killers. And they will use that as a justification to take away the possessions of the Jewish brother, whom they're supposed to embrace and show a redemptive act. This is what we've been studying, is to see the redemption within the household of Israel. And that's what we want to see take place. And that's why he's going to judge so harshly those who claim to be of the household of Elohim, but yet will do these various things that don't speak of the true heart of what Yeshua has.
See, we also see it here when he says to the wicked, Yahweh says, or Elohim says, what right have you to tell of my statutes? The wicked in and of themselves don't tell of his statutes. His people do. So there's a group of his people that he calls wicked that he says are telling of his statutes, that are taking upon them his covenant. They hate his discipline, his instruction. How much do we hate that in Ephraim today? We discard his words. We cast them behind us. Well, that's behind us. That's for the past. That's not for us anymore. And when you see a thief, you are pleased with him. Do I dare say turn on Christian TV? And you associate with adulterers. Well, how many people, even maybe some of us in the past, have turned on Christian TV thinking we were doing the right thing, not knowing in our blindness and our hardness of heart that we were in fact associating with those adulterers and so pleased with them that we were even rewarding them with tithes and offerings that rightly didn't belong to them. You know, we've all done those things in our wickedness that he is delivering us out of. But now he says, you let your mouth loose in evil, your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. Like Ron was just saying, we speak against our brother almost every day, I hear it. You know, Judah this, Judah that. When Tom and I were in our previous church, we came up against people that, you know, we started acting a little too Jewish for them in their mind, thought even though we weren't acting Jewish at all, we were acting more Torah-like, more scriptural. And we had people who actually wanted to cause us harm. Well, why was that? Because they were against the brother. And in fact, slandering your own mother's son. But yet he's kept silent. Why is he kept silent? One, because he is going to judge in the end. But two, he's also kept silent for a while to see in this time now if we'll be delivered, if we choose to be delivered. Because he's delivered all of us, but we have to choose to come out of that. We have to choose to come back to the truth. And in fact, then, we choose on how we will be judged. Will we come back to the truth and walk in his ways and choose a lighter punishment? Or will we continue to walk in this wickedness of verses 16 through 21 and choose very harsh punishment upon us? It's our choice.
I knew she did. See? See? She studied. Anybody else in congregation or in Pow Talk? Thoughts, questions, comments? We're in Psalm chapter 50. And you brought it out between Mark and Teresa. You showed it. But once again, I'd like to iterate it because it's important, what has already been brought out. And it's talking to a people that takes his covenant in their mouth, say, I'm a believer of the Almighty, but they hate instruction. They hate Torah, and they cast my words behind you. Ye say the Torah is the past. We don't need to follow the Torah. A people that's taken his covenant in their mouth, but they don't want to follow Torah. That's today's Christianity. That's today's Christianity. Bill?
There's
can't think of the scripture now. When we did Passover a couple times, some of the people from the Seventh-day Adventists were there, do you remember, on it, and they brought out the scripture that says, see here, Yahweh says he hates their feast days, so then why do you do them? I says, you know what? You're forgetting something. Go back to the first part of the chapter. The reason he did, because they weren't walking in his way. The tongue was professing it, but you didn't see the fruit thereof. And basically, that's what this is here. These people are saying, well, yeah, I believe this and I believe that, but they don't do it. They don't do it. And that's the danger of it all. We've had some people in our group said, I want to learn about the feast days now, but I don't want to do them. And they are in trouble today, especially the one couple. I guarantee you, folks, this couple, she's had major heart operations. And the other man's back. They're divorced today. And I told him it was a dangerous thing what they were saying, and it proved it out today. They're so far away from the Lord, it's pathetic.
Well, look at what it says after this section of, you know, he goes through his people and then he gets to these wicked. After the wicked in verse 22, he says, now consider this, you who forget God. What he's coming out... He's saying, you knew me, but yet you, again, you're telling of my statutes, you're claiming my covenant, but you don't follow my instruction. My words aren't for you, you say. You're associating with adulterers, in other words, those who associate with other gods and other lords besides me. You're doing all these things. He says, this is, in fact, forgetting who I am. It's interesting because when we get back to Revelation, we see, come back to your first love. You used to know me. You used to love me. And now you're doing all these things. You need to come back, and you need to come back now. You know, earlier today I was telling Susie, and I've told Tom this in the past week since I've been getting my voice back, one of the things I sense coming up is a trumpet call, if you will. And that trumpet call, I think, I could be way off on this, is going to be some event. I think in the next 12 to 18 months, there's going to be some event that those who are in tune with the Ruach HaKodesh are going to know. And that trumpet is going to say to those who are listening, this is your final call. Wake up now. If you need to get ready to leave, do it immediately. You will not get another warning. And I really sense that coming. And those who won't hear that are those who he's talking about. Now consider this, you who forget God. Because if you don't, as he says here, there will be none to deliver. We either go his way or we don't go at all. We can choose to have him as our deliverer, or we can choose to forget him and ignore that trumpet call that's coming and do all these things that he's rightfully judged us in doing, and then he'll say, just as in the five foolish virgins, there is none to deliver.
That final trumpet call may be in the next couple of weeks. Anticipation. Watch out for that meeting that's happening in Jerusalem in 2 weeks.
Well, not only, you know, whatever happens May the 13th through the 18th when Bush goes to Israel in the Middle East, but we're entering in the next month or two where a decision has to be made about Iran as well. So we'll see what happens.
Karen, continue with that same thought. What Bill had talked about in regards to the rejecting of the feasts of the people, it's found in Isaiah chapter 1, and it's verse 14 says, I hate your new moons and festivals and your appointed feasts. They have become a burden to me, and we're bearing them. He's not speaking of his feast, the feast of Yahweh. He's speaking about what the people had done, like what happened in the northern kingdom. And what the same thing has happened with, again, we look at the Ephraimite believers that have basically paganized themselves, which we know now as Western Christianity, in regards to not having come out of Constantinian doctrine, holding to the Sunday worship, holding to other festivals that are not established within the feast of Yahweh, but yet are set apart by the Christian church as being holy days, but yet are not. These are the things that he's speaking to. He's talking to these people, and he's talking to us as well. We need to continue to look at our own lives and find out if we're doing the things that he's called us to do, which is to defend the widow and the orphan, to reach out and to be redemptive in the things that we're supposed to do. You see it in Isaiah chapter 58 as well. It talks about, now look at the fast you've chosen. Is it a day for bowing the head and for putting on sackcloth and, you know, putting ashes upon your head? No, it's to go out and to do the things that are redemptive. Those are the things that are really the fasts that Yahweh that calls us to do, to be redemptive in regards to reaching out and helping those and just trying to see Zion, which is so important. If Yahweh had not been careful to watch over Zion, Zion would have been left like Sodom and Gomorrah. It says in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 8, the daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a watchman's hut in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Unless Yahweh of hosts had left us a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom. We would have become like Gomorrah. So it is that Yahweh is the one that's going to give us the power to be able to be redemptive and to continue to be that remnant, to be that elect, as we continue to seek Him and to seek to walk in His ways, and to be continually being willing to be made more holy, to be sanctified. It's about sanctification.
I need to connect a couple of more dots. In Psalm chapter 50 and verse 2, it says, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, Elohim hath shined. I want to make that connection to Ezekiel chapter 28, where it says, here it is in verse 12, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith Elohim, Adonai Yahweh, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. And this is speaking of Hasatan. So I'm making the connection because I just want to point out that the people later on in Psalm 50 who are called the wicked are the ones who are following after Hasatan, thinking probably that they're following after Yahweh. So the connection, perfection and beauty, is I had to point it up.
If we're wondering how do you get from there to here, go back to Psalm 24, verses 4 and 5, and this is the plea. Show me thy way, O Yahweh, teach me thy paths, lead me in thy truths, and teach me, for thou art Yahweh of my salvation. That's how you get there.
Which fits in with the closing verse of Psalm 50. He who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me, to him who orders his walk, I will show or manifest the salvation of God. So again, if you contrast that again, this didactic theme that's going through here, this didactic tone in Psalm 50, but you've got the contrast back and forth and back and forth. And in 22, you forget God, there's no one to deliver. But in 23, if you will yet order your way, order your walk in the right way. Well, how do we walk in the right way? What does Psalm 119 say? Follow the Torah.
True. Torah is true.
You know, that's our walk. If we will walk in that way, then we will see the salvation of God.
Right.
But again, it's our choice. Just as Rebecca had a choice when Abraham's servant came for her, we have that choice.
So in that verse, this whole psalm is a picture of exile and redemption.
Absolutely. And you know what?
Amazing!
Everything is our choice. Yahweh is absolutely in charge of everything that happens. He is sovereign of everything that happens, but he is not a bully who will force us to do what we don't want to do. He leaves us a choice to follow him or not. Okay? And that's all there is to that. Now consider this, ye that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces and there be none to deliver. Okay? You'd better wake up. And that goes for each and every one of us in this room and in Pal Talk as well. Wake up. Okay, you gotta put it all on the line.
Tom.
Three times, Tom?
That last,
I'm going to be raptured.
That last verse is a perfect redemption. Ishin of Elohim. I can just picture, you know, in the tribulation, and you're wondering, how is he going to do it? But he's going to show us the salvation. He's going to bring us through.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? We are on Psalm 50. Let's go to the Brit Hadashah, Hebrews chapter 8, beginning in verse 6. But now has he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is a mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. For if the first, the word covenant is in italics, it's not in the text. For if the original had been faultless, there should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them. Notice what the problem is. The problem is with them. That is the receivers. The problem is not with the giver or the gift. The problem is not with the giver or the gift, but the problem is with the receivers. So, what at Mount Sinai did Yahweh find fault with? He found fault with the stony hearts of the receivers. So what he did is he renewed the covenant, and in renewing the covenant, the renewed covenant has better promises. Now the renewed covenant is also Torah based, but the renewed covenant is ratified in the blood of Messiah, not in the blood of goats. Still, it's to follow Torah, but the ratification of the covenant is in the blood of Messiah rather than the blood of bulls and goats. And we are given in the renewed covenant the power of the indwelling Holy Spirit to overcome the flesh. That's better.
It's interesting, Eddie, that he said not in the blood of bulls and goats, but he didn't say anything about sheep at that point. No. Just go ahead.
So, finding fault with them, he says, behold, the days come that I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not. So the new covenant is not according to that covenant. No, the new covenant, as we're told in Ezekiel chapter 36, verses 26 and 27, is the Torah written upon a heart of flesh, rather than a Torah written upon a heart of stone. For this is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. I will put my Torah in my mind, write in their hearts. I believe their Elohim, they will be my people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know Yahweh, for they all know me from the least to the greatest. Now this is quoting Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 33. Now, for I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and iniquities will I remember no more. Now, verse 13 says, in that he says a new, the word covenant is in italics, it's not in the text. And that he says a new, well, now what's the new? The renewed covenant, which is the Torah written upon a heart of flesh. So, a Torah written upon the heart of flesh, he's made the first old. What did he make old? A Torah written upon a heart of stone. So, what he made new was the Torah written upon a heart of flesh. What is old is the Torah written upon a heart of stone. Now that which decays and waxes old, what's decays and waxing old? The Torah written upon a heart of stone. What's a Torah written upon a heart of stone? You follow after the flesh. So what is to be old and decay away in Messiah? Our carnal nature, our fleshly man. It's to die, where we are to be renewed by the Spirit, live in Messiah, have the life of Messiah, have the power of the Holy Spirit, and the fruit of the Holy Spirit. And so, it's this misunderstanding of the difference between the covenant at Mount Sinai, which was the Torah written upon a heart of stone, versus the renewed covenant, which is associated with Mount Zion, which is the Torah written upon a heart of flesh. It's not understanding that Hebrews 8:13 has been interpreted that the old covenant or the Torah has been done away. Mark.
May I take issue?
You can try.
Am I? mainly because I don't really think that it's talking about Torah. I believe that it's talking about the priesthood. If you look back at the beginning of chapter 8, it says...
Wait a second. every covenant has to have a priesthood. So
exactly.
If you're talking about the renewed covenant, you are also talking about the priesthood, because every covenant has to have a priesthood that oversees it. So you're right. It's one and the same.
Right. Okay. When it says a new, it's talking about, it has just gotten finished. Chapter 7 has just gotten finished with talking about the Melchizedek priesthood and how it's better than the Aaronic priesthood. Chapter 8 talks about exactly the same thing. For every high priest, in verse 3, is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer, talking about Yeshua. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law. So he's talking about the Levitical priesthood that is still in existence at the time that this is written, because the temple is still in existence and they're still offering sacrifices. Okay, so this Melchizedek priesthood is worthless in this economy, that economy. But now that the temple is gone, you need to have a different priest and a different priesthood. And that's where the Melchizedek priesthood comes in. And that, I believe, is what we're talking about from verse 8 and following. Finding fault with them, he's talking about the priests. He saith, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. And that whole thing, the only place where covenant is mentioned is in verse 9, has nothing to do with what he's talking about before or after. In that he saith a new priesthood, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. And that, in effect, is exactly what was going on at that time. The Levitical priesthood was old. It was getting ready to vanish away. They were about to destroy the temple. And therefore, there would be no use for the Levitical priesthood anymore. I see both applications as being very valid in this point.
Well, guess what? If you see both applications, that's Hebraic thought, because there's multiple levels and it's a circle and everything's connected with everything else. And so obviously what you shared is in the context of the text, because Hebrews 7 leads into Hebrews 8. So it's right there. Go ahead.
Yes. Back in Exodus chapter 13, in verses 9 and 16, it talked about being upon your hand. It would be upon your hand, and it would be before your eyes. It's frontless before your eyes. And I believe it's referring to the same thing, in that it's the law, the covenant law, of the beauty of what Yahweh's bringing us into and giving us His instruction, making us in more into the character of Messiah, making us more like Himself. And that's only going to be accomplished by the covenant through Messiah Yeshua, whereby the Spirit is able to inhabit us all to, if we are willing, against a willing heart, being able to apply our heart and our mind. So it's continually before us, and it is changing us, and we're not seeing the fullness of it yet. We're in the process. We're still in the in vitro, being able to be brought to full birth at the time when He establishes His kingdom, so that we all together see the fullness of it. It is a glorious thing to experience this redemptive work that is even now bringing us to a better place. The cleansing of the mind, the cleansing of the heart, the cleansing of the life, so that we can become more like unto Messiah Himself and be able to appreciate the glory and the beauty of Yahweh in our relationship with Him.
Very good. Very good. Is there anything else that anyone would like to share regarding Hebrews chapter 8? Basically, as we saw Mark point out, you can't just start at verse 6. You have to go back and see chapter 7, verses 1 through, and you gotta keep things in context. So Yeshua is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is what Hebrews writes about. And it's the high priest that oversees the covenant. Because it was the firstborn who originally is the one that oversaw the sacrifices. Yeshua is the firstborn. He's the high priest. So he's got a renewed covenant's got to be made. But what's the priesthood of the renewed covenant? The Melchizedek priesthood is that, because the Melchizedek priesthood is an eternal priesthood. And it is superior to the Levitical priesthood. We have a question.
It's important for us to understand that when it says after the order of Melchizedek, it's not talking about there are different orders of priests like in the Catholic Church, where, you know, you got the Dominicans and you got the Jesuits and you got all these different things. Okay? An order of priest is just in the same manner as Melchizedek was a priest, so also is Yeshua.
We have a question. Do you see the Levitical priesthood and the priesthood of Melchizedek running concurrently in the millennial kingdom?
Yes.
The answer is yes, and you can see that if you go back to Ezekiel 45 and Ezekiel 46. Also, it says in Isaiah 66 that Yahweh will take and make Levites from the nations. Bill.
To me, verse 10 and verse 11, showing the future, what's going to take place. This is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel.
Right.
After those days.
Still saying that in Hebrews.
It says, I will put my laws within their mind and write them on their hearts, and I will be unto them a God, and they shall be unto me a people. Now, the church well better understand this. What it's saying here, that he will. But the thing is, the he will has to do with the I will. You know, and the timing.
The timing too,
yeah.
After
right, after those days. The tribulation day. And the good part here is, he says, and they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know Yahweh, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. One day. That's going to be the day that they will know him. How will they know him? Because I think that they followed the instructions that was given to them originally. You know, he is the lawgiver. You have to know who he is first. And he gave the law. This does not counteract anything that was given of the law, because every law that was ever given by Yahweh is perfect. The imperfection comes with the heart of man, and with the hardness and the disobedience. That's where the hardness of the heart is, a disobedience. And a good lesson is to remember the potter. Who's the potter? Who's the clay? If we stay flexible, if we stay like flesh, then we can learn. But if we harden our heart and it drops off the potter's wheel, it's useless. It can't be used again.
That's good. The fact is the Levitical priesthood wasn't created until after the fall at Sinai. We were supposed to all be priests and kings, okay? A royal priesthood, okay? And when you think about that, that's Melchizedek. He's a royal priest. We were supposed to all be a Melchizedek priesthood. An interim, that's the Levitical priesthood.
Right, and that's why, just as it says in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, still here we've got
Levitical priesthood. Malachi has some things to say about, of course, Yahweh speaking through Malachi, his prophet, in the second chapter. And this is how it begins in the first verse. And now this commandment is for you, O priests, if you do not listen, if you do not take it to heart to give honor to my name, says Yahweh of hosts, then I will send the curse upon you, and I will curse your blessing, and indeed I have cursed them already, because you are not taking it to heart. Again, we're talking about the heart. Behold, I am going to rebuke your offspring, and I will spread refuse in your faces, the refuse of your feasts, and you will be taken away with it. Then you will know that I have sent this commandment to you that my covenant may continue, that my covenant may continue with Levi, says Yahweh of hosts. My covenant with him was one of life and peace, and I gave them to him as an object of reverence, so he revered me and stood in awe of my name. True instruction was in his mouth, and unrighteousness was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and uprightness, and he turned many back from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should preserve knowledge, and men should seek instruction from his mouth. For he is the messenger of Elohim of hosts. But as for you, you have turned aside from the way. You have caused many to stumble by the instruction. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says Yahweh of hosts. So I have made you despised and abased before all the people, just as you are keeping, just as you are not keeping my ways, but are showing partiality in all the instruction.
Anything else that anyone would like to share regarding Hebrews chapter 8? We will go to chapter 9, verse 1, and then verses 13 through 15. For verily the first had also ordinance of divine service in a worldly sanctuary. For if the blood of bulls and goats and ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Messiah, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to Elohim, purge your conscience from dead works? And for this cause he's the mediator of a new testament, that by the means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. So once again, through Messiah's death, he's by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant. Who did he redeem? A firstborn nation. He redeemed a firstborn nation. So chapter 9, verse 1, for verily the first had ordinances of divine service. The services that were done in the temple were divine. Where do we have scripture showing us that they were divine in origin?
Right here.
The answer is 2 Chronicles. In 1 Chronicles chapter 28. Verse 11. 1 Chronicles 28, verse 11. Then David gave to Solomon his son the pattern of the porch and of the houses, of the treasuries and the upper chambers, of the inner parlors, and of the place of the mercy seat, of the pattern of all that he had by the Ruach. By the pattern of all that he had, the pattern by the Ruach. And of the courts of the houses of Yahweh and all the chambers, and of the treasuries of the house of Yahweh and the treasuries of dedicated things, and for the courses of the priests and Levites, for all the work of the service of the house of Yahweh, and for all the vessels of service in the house of Yahweh. All of that was of divine origin because David gave it to Solomon and everything that he had gotten by the Ruach. 1 Chronicles chapter 28. Verse 12. Then in the future, Ezekiel in chapter 43 and beginning in verse 10, it says the following. Son of man, show the house to the house of Israel. Show the house, that is the temple, to the house, that's the people, that they may be ashamed of their iniquity, and let them measure the pattern. The pattern of what? The temple. This is talking about the future temple. And if they be ashamed of all they've done, show them the form of the house, show them the form, the fashion, the going out, the coming in, all the forms, all the ordinances. Write it in their sight that they may keep the whole form and all the ordinances to do them. This is the Torah of the house. What is the Torah of the house? To show the house to the house, according to the pattern. And so we are actually going to be instructed about understanding the Messiah, why we need the Messiah, what the Messiah did, and the ways of the kingdom, and how we are to serve in the kingdom by looking at the pattern of the temple and everything regarding it. That's, and we have people even in our congregation here who are very knowledgeable and well versed on the tabernacle and the elements and aspects of it and what they all mean as related to Messiah and our relationship unto him. Teresa.
Well, we've also, it goes back even further, since you just mentioned the tabernacle, to Exodus 25 and Numbers chapter 8, where the tabernacle was given to Moses, and it says, make it according to the pattern which I have shown you. So it was given straight from Yahweh to Moshe. Now, the tabernacle is the pattern for the temple. But I believe, and I think this is back can be backed up from Scripture, and off the top of my head, I'm not sure at the moment, I'm still recovering here, but Mark's making a crude comment, but that's okay. The pattern of the tabernacle that was given to Moshe, I believe Yahweh actually let him see the pattern of the tabernacle that stands in the heavenlies where Yahweh serves.
Absolutely
now.
Right.
Where
absolutely
he sits
right
in the high places now, where he sits in the Holy of Holies, where Yeshua sits at his right hand.
The
that's all.
The First Chronicles that we just
is
saw.
The same thing.
It's the same as
it's the exact same
Hebrews
thing.
10,
exactly.
Same as
it all goes case back to the pattern that was given to him via Yahweh on Mount Sinai.
I find it interesting, too, that from what Eddie had read in regards to Ezekiel, how he was given the pattern of the tabernacle or temple that was to be built, that it would cause the people of his day to consider and cause them to have repentant hearts. And so we see the good things that Yahweh has prepared and how it was different. It wasn't the same temple that they had, the same rituals. There was a different type of the court was the same, but when you got into the holy place, there were different implements that were there. And even as we then move into the book of Revelation, there is a blessing that's given that those that would read the Revelation would receive a blessing. I believe that the blessing is when you get through it, you see that what forth Yahweh is bringing about and what he has for us that would cause us then too to be repentant in heart and to be willing to be humbled before him to realize what good things that are expected can be expected by true believers. Because he has a tremendous amount of design and purpose, the things that go beyond what we can comprehend, but yet he's given us a glimpse of eternity and allowing it to then be a motivating factor for us to then turn away from fruitless pursuits in the world, but instead to be redemptive in the things that he calls us to do.
If I may, I want to run back to chapter 8 for just a second here. It says in that this covenant is made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah in chapter 8, verse 8 rather. But in verse 10, it says this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. Okay, so it's not talking about the house of Judah at that particular point either. Unless it's talking about the two of them together, which is really what I think, I was just reading through there again. This covenant, this first covenant they use the word covenant, but it has nothing to do with that. It's the priesthood, I think, because it says in verse 8, for finding fault with them. That first was not right, because finding fault with them. So it's not talking about a covenant. It's talking about a group of something. So it tells me that it's the priesthood. Anyway. There are no Gentiles involved. What's better about this new covenant that we are partakers of, not that we are in the middle of, because this covenant doesn't start until after the tribulation. It isn't finalized until after the tribulation. What's cool about it is its finality. We will see a better sacrifice. We see a better sacrifice, rather, right now, and that is the basis for the better everything else that we see in Hebrews. He's a better priest because he offered a better sacrifice. He's better than the angels because he offered a better sacrifice. Everything is better because he offered a better sacrifice than that which we had under the Levitical priesthood, which was bulls and goats that really couldn't pay for the sins. They all looked forward to Messiah, And when we have them reestablished as offerings in the third temple, they will be looking back to the sacrifice of Yeshua, who fulfills all of those sacrifices. Okay. Go ahead.
When it talks about new covenant, it reminded me to go back into Matthew. Why does it say new covenant or renew covenant? It has to be totally different. Everything that takes place, the whole aspect of it has to be totally different. You can't put new wine in old bottles, lest the bottle break and everything is lost. You put the new wine in the new bottles, and then you won't perish.
Also, a lot of times I get asked, well, what do you mean the new covenant isn't enacted yet? Oh, Eddie says somebody's asking that in Pal Talk. Okay, I had a feeling somebody was. I just could feel it in my gut because I get that asked all the time. Remember, we need to follow patterns. We were talking just a few minutes ago about the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of the temple and the pattern of the priesthood. This also is a pattern. Yahweh works everything in patterns. That's why the feast and the tabernacle are so important. When Yahweh redeemed his people in Egypt, when he redeemed us from Egypt, the Lamb, that was not a covenant. That was a Passover. That was redemption. It wasn't until he brought us out through tribulation of Pharaoh chasing us down and going through the Red Sea to get us to Sinai, to get us to Shavuot, until a covenant was made. So it was after the tribulation of that those days. It's the same thing now. We, you and I, have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. It is not a covenant. It is redemption from this world, also known as Egypt. But now we have to go through the tribulation of those days, of these days, to get to Sinai again, if you will. In this case, it'll be Zion, according to the new covenant. It'll be Mount Zion instead of Mount Sinai, where that covenant will be enacted. He will make a covenant with us, and just like Israel did at Sinai, we, Zion, will say, yes, everything you have said we will do. We will be your bride. It's the same pattern again and again. We are redeemed. We must go through tribulation to get to the covenant. And we're not through tribulation yet.
I don't know if anyone else noticed this, but this is not an exact quote of Jeremiah chapter 31 that we see here in Hebrews chapter 8. It's close, but there is a phrase that's very different, and that is, I'll do it from Jeremiah first, where it says, that I took them by the hand and bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them. It doesn't say, although I was an husband unto them in Hebrews. It says, and I regarded them not. Now, that's entirely different. But we need to understand, what we need to remember is that Hebrews is not necessarily didactic in everything that it says. They're not just teaching you something rote. All right, this is midrashic. I mean, almost the entire book is midrashic, and so it's not literal. And they will take things, they'll quote things out of context, they'll quote things inaccurately, purposely to make a point. Now, where it says, "And I regarded them not," my comment to that is this, and it's a midrash, so I'm allowed to say this. Okay, he disregarded them and let their whole generation die in the wilderness because they disregarded his covenant. Okay? So he disregarded them. There were only two people that didn't disregard his covenant, and they got to go into the land. A midrash on the midrash.
In regards to his covenant, it isn't static. It continues to be progressive as you move. There was a covenant established with Abraham. It was, first of all, established with Adam, and then it was established with Noah, and then Abraham, and then it went to Isaac, and then to Jacob, and then to Ephraim. And there, at Passover, there was a covenant that was established, and then it was expanded as they went to Mount Sinai, and it had to be adjusted and modified because of the golden calf. Continually, Yahweh is modifying and adjusting the covenant. He's keeping his... He's what?
He's adjusting us, not the covenant. The covenant's perfect.
The covenant is changed in that there are elements that are being modified as well. It's not just a matter of changing us, but it's also changing the way in which he's working. Right now, we don't have the temple. It's going to be established, but it's not going to be the same way. There are not going to be the same implements that will be there as it were in the tabernacle that were in the original temple. If you read about what happened when Ezekiel was given the vision for the new temple that was to take place during the Messianic era, it's not the same. It's different. So I'm not saying that the character of Yahweh is changing. Not at all. But he is taking, and he's taking a people, and he's bringing a people onto righteousness. And in the process of doing that, he is making modifications as he goes along to bring about truth. I believe he's making the correct modifications to bring about what his truth and his plan of redemption would be.
Whoops. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments, either here in the congregation or in Pal Talk Land? We are discussing Hebrews chapter 8 into Hebrews and chapter 9.
I have a question. When I was saying something to Teresa, it talks about the divine service of the ordinance of the first covenant, but then it says, and a worldly sanctuary. Is this one that is very mundane, that has the elements of the world in it, as we see today? Is it talking about that?
Or I'm thinking it's talking about a sanctuary that's in the earth. That was.
It's an earth.
Exactly.
In this earth.
It's also, again, going back to what Mark said earlier, not the covenant. The word covenant is not there in the original. That's why
right.
The translators have put this word in italics over and over and over again. I think it goes back to what Mark said earlier about the priesthood. But even if we don't put any word there, now even the first had regulations of divine worship and earthly sanctuary. This has to do with what was going on, what form of worship was going on in that sanctuary, what the people were doing and how they did it. Again, it goes back to the priesthood. Because, as Mark said, we screwed up, and so we had to now rely on Yahweh's way of the Levitical priest. It wasn't the plan. He changed the way it had to be done so that we could come to him because we were so filthy and wretched and miserable. But he's taking that, he's changing that priesthood again, and instead of those regulations of divine worship and earthly sanctuary, we're going to do not according to the pattern that Moshe was shown, we're going to do according to the heavenlies. As Yeshua said when he was asked, you know, what should we do? And he said, pray as it is in heaven. You know, let it be done here as it is in heaven. Not let it be done there as it is here. We always get it backwards. We have this thing in Western Gentile Christianity right now that says, well, whatever I bind on earth is bound in heaven, and whatever I bind in heaven is bound on earth, and therefore God's going to bend to our will. Quite the opposite. That's 180 degrees off. We're bending to his will, or we will be broken. That's the only option.
Yes, and having read through this portion of Hebrews and a little bit farther before and afterward, you read where they have the italicized word covenant, and if you place in the word priesthood, which I've done, it works in a few places, but it won't work all the way through. The word covenant will work if you place it in there. It makes sense, but it makes sense in the context. But if you have the word priesthood stuck in, it will not fit all the way through where they have the word italicized covenant.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? We are still discussing the book of Hebrews, specifically chapters 8 and 9. And here's the challenge when you're reading a book like the book of Hebrews. You have to have a solid background and understanding of Torah, and you have to have a not only an understanding of Torah, but Torah thought and the concept of Midrash and all these other things to be able to understand what is being communicated. Mark?
That's the reason that people get in trouble in Hebrews. And in Rome. Actually, in all of Paul's writings, it's almost all Midrash. if you don't understand that the Pharisees, in particular, taught Midrashically, and Paul was a Pharisee, and Yeshua was a Pharisee, and they were all, every time they taught, they were teaching a midrash. I mean, they were doing it by midrash. And that's because they speak in dark sayings, parables, things that you need to have a key for in order to get it to open up properly. And that's all there is to that. Now,
That's fair to say.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Let me make one quick comment before you go on. Now, you made a point earlier about how from Jeremiah 31 in Hebrews, it's not exact. Well, we have this thing called the Targums, and the Targums isn't iterate the exact same thing as the Torah itself, but pretty close. And so, this little slight difference. Is sort of like a targum.
That could very well
rendition.
Be.
A targum having, rendition,
having
which
never
is like
seen
midrashic.
Targum, I wouldn't know.
Well,
yeah.
Targum. It's all the way of understanding the Torah. Yeah. Now you go ahead. What you're going to say?
I was just going to comment on verse 14, where it says, "Purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living Elohim." First thing is. It talks about a testament. I think it's in the next verse, the end, in verse 15. It talks about a new testament. Testaments and covenants are different things. Okay, so if it's talking about a covenant, it's not talking about a testament. Okay, a covenant is a promise to perform, and a testament is a last will. Okay, and it's not a matter of a performance. But a testament specifies the inheritance from the testator to the testatee. A covenant specifies the conditions by which the testatee receives the inheritance. The old covenant, made effective by the blood of animals, was transitory. Reliance on it afforded only a transitory inheritance. Miss an atoning sacrifice, lose the inheritance. The new covenant is made effective by the blood of Messiah and is perfect and permanent. Reliance on it provides an eternal inheritance. Okay? So, that's how our consciences get purged. In the Levitical way of doing things, like I said, you go from atonement to atonement, and you never do lose the guilt. The guilt is always there. Okay, of the sins that you've committed, the guilt is taken away by Messiah, by the blood of His covenant. The guilt is just removed. And if we're still feeling guilty about the sins that we've committed and have confessed and turned away from, then we haven't really turned away from them. Okay? And it's time to get our consciences purged of those things. We need to really and truly turn away from them and go Yah's way. Anybody else?
Let me clarify some thoughts, comments that are being made on Pal Talk, where you said, Mark, that Paul was a Pharisee and Yeshua was a Pharisee. Now, Paul specifically was a Pharisee. Now, Yeshua didn't join a club or a sect when he went walking the earth. Now, much of what he did was Pharisaic, but not 100% of what he did and was Pharisaic. So he most strongly aligned himself with the Pharisees, but he wasn't officially a member of the club itself, like Paul was a member of the club. So I think basically, and Mark, I don't want to put words in your mouth, was that basically much of what Yeshua did and taught aligned itself with the Pharisees and Pharisaic thought.
I believe that he was taught Pharisaic thought by Pharisees. I believe that he was a member of the sect, at least for a while. And here's why. In John chapter 1, in verse 26, John the Baptist answered them, the Pharisees, saying, "I baptize with water, but there standeth one among you whom ye know not. He it is who coming after me is preferred before me, whose shoe latchet I am not worthy to unloose." Okay, he's talking about Yeshua. He's telling the Pharisees that he stands among them. Okay, so I believe that means that he has been taught Pharisaic thought. I think one of the reasons that the Pharisees hated him so much was because they taught him, and he rejected much of what they taught. And the same thing with Paul. They hated Paul so much because they taught him. He was their chief rabbinic student, and he rejected much of what they taught later on.
I agree. Not only did they reject it, but when you look at what they said and what they wrote, well, what Paul wrote, what Yeshua said and what Paul said, they not only rejected it and said they rejected it, but especially in Yeshua's teachings, when you read the Gospels, he quoted it verbatim, and then he taught exactly why it was wrong and went against Yahweh's path, why it went against Torah. It wasn't just a matter of, oh, I no longer choose to accept that, like so many people back in those days were doing, and all these sects were breaking off of Pharisaism and the Sadducees and saying, no, we reject this teaching or that teaching, and we're going to start our own sect, our own denomination, if you will. Yeshua never started a new denomination. Yeah. To this day, almost 2,000 years later, he has not started a new denomination. Yeah. He was showing the errors in the one that existed. He was showing where it had been corrupted. So not only was he coming against them, but he was doing it with their very own words.
That's right. I'll tell you what, there are three places in John chapter 1 where it says that somebody did not know who Yeshua was. Okay? There was the world didn't know him in verse 10. The Pharisees didn't know him in verse 26. And John himself didn't know him in verses 31 and 33. Okay? Did not know that he was Messiah. That's what the word says. Okay? The Pharisees didn't know him even though he was among them.
Since a lot of Christians doesn't understand that Pharisaic is there were different sects. And so they had different their beliefs in every area were not always uniform. Just like there's different denominations of Christianity. So when Yeshua may have been condemning the Pharisees or maybe a particular sect or a particular belief, or anyone who tried to be religious but were religious outwardly but were not following according to the heart and the spirit, it would be no different than going into a Baptist church or a Pentecostal church or a Catholic church or a Sunday Protestant church or Seventh-day Adventist, and maybe pointing out and correcting, rebuking some of the things that are that were going on. It doesn't mean that he's against a believer. He's rebuking and correcting that which he sees going on within the faith, as you might say.
And I think that's why it was so important that he pointed out to tell us, you know, when you do that, first get the beam out of your own eye, because we so many times, as feeble human beings that we are, screwed up sinners that we have been in the past, think that when we see someone else's error, we're better than. And we're not. Because so many times, not only are we doing the same thing in another way, many times we're making things worse. When we see somebody else's error, there is a way to correct, there is a way to, you know, confront if necessary and deal with that error. But a lot of times, just back in Yeshua's, as it was back in Yeshua's day, and there were sects breaking off of Phariseeism and Sadduceeism and all these other things, as you pointed out, you know, just like today, the Roman Catholic Church, Protestant Christianity and all the denominations, it's the same thing. And these sects break off or broke off in the day of Yeshua, and they tried to clean up the errors they saw, but many times created more errors. The one that often comes to my mind, because I deal with this a lot with people that I go back and forth with on email a lot, are, for instance, some of these sects of Phariseeism that broke off, broke Torah and adding to or taking away from Torah. They said, no, we don't do that, we do this. Some of the sects changed what we commonly call the Ten Commandments. Some of the sects changed where they worshipped or how they worshipped. Some of the sects added actual books, if you will, or scrolls of scripture. All, in effect, making Torah null and void to them. So they were correcting the errors they saw in the Pharisees that they broke away from. But many times we want to say now, today, in the Hebraic Roots movement, I'm getting a lot of argument, well, we need to break away from this Pharisaic Judaism. I could not agree more. We need to break away from that, but we need to get back to Torah. We don't need to go to another sect of Phariseeism that we think we had it more right when they added scrolls, when they took away or changed commandments, when they changed the places or orders of worship or the feast days or anything like that. Because in that case, we're just as wicked, and we have done exactly what Yeshua said in taking and becoming a convert of the Pharisees, but becoming twice the son or daughter of hell that they are. So we need to be very, very cautious in how we walk that way.
Anybody else? Congregation, Pal Talk Land? Have any further thoughts, questions, comments? As we are still discussing Hebrews 8 and Hebrews in chapter 9. Ron, did you have your hand up or no? Was you wanting to say something? I thought you did. Well, you have an opportunity here if you want to.
Here comes Ron to
share
something
before we close things up.
Did you lick the bowl, Ron?
No, I haven't got to the last piece yet. I'm still saving the last piece.
There's someone on Pal Talk asking.
The last piece.
There's someone on Pal Talk asking if you can make some tzitziot.
Yeah, have them email me.
Yeah, have them. Email her by going to ezrastable.org and there you can contact her. Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, and in the first chapter of the book of John, there's a new thought that begins at verse 19, and it begins and continues a paragraph all the way through verse 29. And it begins this way at verse 19.
Where yet?
And the book of John.
Book of John, chapter?
Chapter 1.
Chapter 1.
And the 19th verse. And it says, this is the witness of John, that when the Jews sent to him priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who are you? And then also, there's a part in verse 24, it says, and now they had been sent from the Pharisees. So first it was the Jews who had sent to ask questions of John, who were of the Levites and the priests. And then in verse 24, it says the Pharisees. And so we still have two groups of people then here that are coming to John and asking him in that day. And then so he goes on to say that I baptize in water, but among you stands one whom you do not know. So it could refer to the Jews, the priests, the Levites. It could refer to the Pharisees from the context of the paragraph.
Okay, if I may. This is my own interpretation of this thing. When it says Jews, it's not talking about the people in general. When it says Jews, I believe it's talking about the leaders of the Hebrew religion. And that includes the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the anybody else, any other E's that there might be out there. In this case, we have the Levites and the leaders of the religion sending people out from Jerusalem saying, who are you? And in verse 24, in the King James, it says, and they which were sent were of the Pharisees. So, or were the Pharisees, because of isn't there either. Oh, yes, it is. I'm sorry. Were of the Pharisees. So, it looks to me like the priests, the Levites, the leaders of the religion sent Pharisees to confront him. Okay? And maybe because they were the intelligentsia of the Hebrew religion, I don't know. But you know, when I'm thinking about Gamaliel teaching Paul, and Paul was definitely an intelligentsia kind of guy. Okay, so that's what I think we got here, is the Pharisees were just the lapdogs that were being sent out by the leaders of religion, who had absolutely no regard whatsoever for Yeshua.
No, I thought that they hated each other. I mean, it's like they did not really have any dealings with each other. There was always a constant contention between the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
They did hate each other, except for one thing. Just as the different sects of Esau, of Islam, hate each other today, except for when any enemy of my enemy is my friend. And they all hated Yeshua and what he was doing and what he was teaching. And so they had a common enemy, and common enemies bring strangers together faster than anything.
Friend of Teresa, someone said on Path Talk you got 100 orders already.
I guess you're going to be working for about a month and a half just getting those things tied, huh? She says she's going to have to get to work to fill all those orders.
Anybody else have a follow-up thought, question, or comment? Anybody else with a follow-up thought, question, comment? Let me, for those of you in Pal Talk land, this is called a midrash. And what a midrash is an open forum for people to share their thoughts, views, and perspective on the scriptures with the ultimate goal of sharpening each other in our understandings and our beliefs and our perspectives of the scripture, of the scriptures. So realize and understand that, you know, this is compared to Greek thought that says, oh, something's right and something's wrong. This is compared to the church that says, if you don't agree with me, then you're a heretic and I can't fellowship with you. This is Midrash, and Midrash is good. It's healthy because it gives a forum for people to be able to share the thoughts and perspective with the goal, the overriding goal, that by doing this, it broadens our understandings and we can learn where we may have not been able to learn before. Mark.
No, I was going to agree with that entirely. Like I've said probably 50 times on Pal Talk in the last 2 or 3 years that we've been doing this, that includes you guys out there. We need to hear from you, what you think about this stuff. Not, you know, don't come here and just get taught. Come here and teach, will you please? Because we don't have all the answers. And you guys probably do have some of them, just like we have some of them. And if we all get together and midrash this thing, you'll be amazed at what kind of an understanding of the scripture we'll all walk away with.
Yeah, so speak up, folks.
Okay, does anybody else have thoughts, questions, comments that they would like to share, either in the congregation or in Pal Talk land? Anyone else at this time? Going once, going twice. We are officially concluded. We'd like to thank you for allowing us to share with you.
Hey, wait a minute, guys. That was only 2.5 hours. We've got to go a little longer.
This time, we pray that you've been blessed, that you've been helped in understanding the scriptures, that most importantly, it has enabled you to grow closer to Yeshua, to His Word, and to bear fruit in the kingdom of heaven. Until we do it again, shalom, in Yeshua the Messiah, amen.